Hello everyone and welcome to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Well, there's a tendency for us here in the West to believe that we are far ahead of other parts of the world in all areas of science, engineering and mathematics. That, of course, is not true. And today we're going to talk to an astronomer based in France about the achievements of early Chinese astronomers who are building instruments to observe star explosions and comets as far back as the 7th century. In the second half of the show today, we'll be continuing on with our astronomical theme. We'll be talking about pulsars. These are a particular form of star that emit light in pulses. They were discovered in the 1960s by Jocelyn Bell Burnell. She was a then 25-year-old Northern Irish woman. These pulsars are a major study today at NUI Galway, at the Centre for Astronomy there. And researchers have recently announced a major breakthrough in our understanding of the 40-year-old puzzle of how pulsars work exactly. But first up, we're going to be talking about the early Chinese astronomers, and I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Jean-Marc Bonnet-Bideau, and he's going to be talking in Dublin next week on this particular subject. Welcome to the show, Jean.
Yes, welcome to you.
You're coming over to Dublin. You're coming over to Dublin next week on the 7th, I think, of September to talk at Dunsink Observatory on Chinese star charts. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. I would love to present a very, very nice document that we have been working on.
Okay. Now, you gave me some notes about this subject, and I find it fascinating. But I suppose the first thing to say in general is that the Chinese were very early. They were involved in very sophisticated studies of the stars, long before the Europeans were doing it.
Yeah, they were very early, and they were very, very consistent with observations. This is the main characteristic of China. They have been observing the sky for 2,000 years nearly continuously.
Okay.
And recording very nicely the celestial events.
And why was it so important for the Chinese to, record the stars? Was there a social reason for it, or what was the driving force for it?
It was extremely important affairs because the emperor was named the son of events, and his main task was to keep harmony between earth and sky.
Okay.
So he has to pay a lot of astronomers to look at the sky and record all the events.
Okay. Now, there's something that you got very interested in. It's a document. It's a famous document, actually, a star chart called the Dun Huang. Is that how you pronounce it? Star
yes,
chart?
Dun Huang, yes.
Maybe tell us about this document. I'm sure most listeners won't have heard of it.
Well, this document is very, very special in history of astronomy because it's the oldest known star chart that we have all civilization known. It's in China,
mm-hmm.
and it was discovered by accident, we should say.
Okay, just to explain maybe to listeners, a star chart, what exactly is that?
A star chart is, of course, it's manuscript, it's drawn by hand, but is a chart, is a map, we could say, where you have plot all the stars that you see in the sky.
Okay. So it'll be slightly different if you do this in China as if you do it in France or Ireland?
Not really, because
no.
We have all the same sky. Only important if you have north or south. But if you are in the north hemisphere, we all see all the same stars.
Okay.
So, but the difference is major because depending on the culture, you will plot them differently and associate the star differently. We call that constellation. Mean constellation is stellar con. Put the star together, and the drawings that you make with those stars is very different from one civilization to another.
Right, it's like how you join the dots, then, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
You can make a different shape or whatever it is.
Yes, and China have a very different way of doing that, and much more precise, because instead of making big constellation, like we know the Big Dipper or things like that, they are very big, they made very small and tiny group of two or three stars sometimes only. Mm. So this was a way for them to give, we say, coordinates by only naming the small constellation.
Mm, okay.
So it was very smart.
Okay, and for other reasons, I suppose, we went for bigger, we wanted to see patterns or shapes or in Europe here. Much later, we had the Big Dipper. It wasn't just two or three stars.
It was ancient way of doing, because we inherited that from the Greek, the ancient Greek. Mm-hmm. So we more or less kept the way of linking the star together. But this was, in Europe, it was more like, you know, mythology.
Okay.
While in China, it was real concrete matter. There was the bed of the emperor, there was the concubine, there were the servants, you know, there was all, we call that the mirror effect.
Mm-hmm.
They were thinking of the sky as a mirror of the earth.
As a mirror of the earth, okay. Now tell us, this document was discovered by accident. It's quite a story, but maybe give us a shortened version of how it was discovered.
Yeah, very short version. Mm. It is in near the Gobi Desert, in the west part of China, in a very desertic place. And there was a Buddhist monastery left over and closed, let's say, near the millennium, 1,000 years modern time, but completely forgotten. And then a monk started to dig around and mm-hmm. clean the... this monastery was curved into a cliff, you know?
Yeah.
With many caves. And in one cave, he knocked against the wall, and there was a strange sound, and he demolished the wall, and he found behind the wall 40,000 manuscripts.
Wow, a huge library.
It's a full library. It's incredible. It's a full library. And because it was in the desert, it was very dry, all the documents are very well preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And this library, so you could date it for 4th century to 10th century. And among that was this chart.
Okay, now you're an astronomer, obviously, so you know there was lots of stuff there, different things, maps and whatever, but this was probably what interested you most.
Yeah, there was nearly this unique astronomical document. The other were more religious texts and calendars. So I was interested by the document, but I thought that many other people have studied the document before me.
Mm.
So I once asked the British Library, because they kept the document now. It was sent by explorers which were there to London, and I asked them, well, do you have some information on the document? And they say, no, we have four lines, it's just a caption.
Okay.
That was all.
So you must have been amazed nobody had looked at this.
I was very amazed, because it's a very beautiful document. So we start to do the what we call the scientific study. Namely, we try to evaluate the accuracy of the map.
Right. And on accuracy and information, how did it measure up?
Well, it was quite a surprise to us, because we discovered that the map, which is a complete sky, you know, it's not only a part of the sky. So you have to solve a very complex mathematical problem, is to project a sphere on a plane.
Okay.
This is very complicated, and it was done in Europe in the 16th century.
Right. So, sorry, I think this was dated, if I'm right, around 650 AD. So our European people, that was 1450. So we were almost 800 years behind.
Exactly. And the dating was accurate, because we made use of a very different method to date the document. And it was, the document was known by a famous sinologist, which is called Joseph Needham,
mm-hmm.
which has written a very huge book, which is called Science and Civilization in China. And he quoted the document, and he gave a date, which was much later, like, you know, 940.
Okay.
We never understood why he gave this date, but we make the study again and we find it's much earlier.
Right. This is because of the paper. You can date the paper, obviously, can't you? With
No. This is unfortunate, because I would like to do that, but the British Library won't let you take a piece of a paper.
Oh, they won't. Not even. All right. So how did you get the date?
I will try to do that later on.
Okay.
Discussion. But we date with from astronomical observation, and from the fact that we find a name in the document, which is very probably the author of the document. It is a famous mathematician and astronomer of the early Tang dynasty, which is the 7th century.
Okay, and from the actual positions of the stars in the sky, you can infer that it was a particular time in history.
We could, but it was not the most accurate method, because, you know, the star, the pole star changed slightly, you know, but very slowly. So it gave us some accuracy of 100 years, so it was not accurate enough. We make use of some specific text in China. They use specific characters, and we find them in documents. We could date accurately.
Okay. So this really, if it goes back that far, this would be probably the oldest atlas of the stars from any part of the world, any civilization?
Yeah. It doesn't mean it was the first ever produced. I mean, we have some documents telling us that some ancient Greek may have produced maps and things like that. but it's certainly the extant one, the one we have still existing today.
Mm. How do they do it? How do they observe? Do they have instruments or what?
They have a lot of instruments. Of course, this is done only naked eye. You can understand that. Mm-hmm. But they were using it's called armillary sphere. Mm. That means a graduate cycle with a thing, with tubes to see the particular sky you want to observe.
A tube. So it's kind of like a very early telescope?
It was a very early telescope, and they were responsible for inventing what we call now the mounting of the modern telescope, because they were taking equator as a reference, and this is a modern way of doing that.
Okay, so if the Chinese were so far ahead of Europe then in astronomy, would they have known, for example, what Copernicus, what was very controversial many, many years later, hundreds and hundreds of years later, that actually the Earth went around the Sun rather than vice versa, things like that?
No, they were not very interested to building a geometrical model of the universe. They were interested to decode what happens in the sky. So it was two different ways of looking at the sky. In Europe, we used to think about something, unchanging. We call that the heaven spheres. The spheres were made of crystal. They would not change,
Yeah.
While the Chinese people, they were thinking of what can change in the sky. And they find very different things that can change. For instance, you were talking about pulsar a minute ago, and pulsar produced by star explosion. And they were very good to point where the star explosion exists in the past.
Okay, so they were monitoring any kind of change that was happening
exactly.
In the heavens.
Exactly, comets. They were extremely good at comets. We could build the Halley Comet now from their observation to a very good accuracy for more than 2,000 years,
Mm-hmm. How did astronomy then continue in China in subsequent centuries? Did they, continue to advance?
Yeah, they did continue and produce much, much better star maps after the Dunhuang charts, And they were even carved onto a stone, so they're still kept in China. And they continued to map but after the Jesuits came to China, there was a misunderstanding between the two. They start to change their way of looking to the sky, and this has stopped and stayed to the same level for many years after that.
Right. What was the main disagreement with the Jesuits?
Well, this particular fact that the Jesuits want to take the ecliptic, which is the line that follow the sun through the sky, as a reference, while the Chinese astronomers were using the equator, which is the most normal way to do. So they changed the Chinese instrument, so there was a big affair between the two, and also in prediction of the eclipse, the Jesuits were much, much better than the Chinese because they have more accurate planetary motion equations,
Okay, and maybe we can use the Chinese data to confirm things in history that, might appear in the historical records.
Yes, we did so. I mean, this is why I came to the subject, because now we're using, satellites, and especially high-energy satellites, capturing X-rays and gamma rays from the sky, then we find some remnant of explosions. Some of the explosions took place several centuries before or even millennium before, but it happens very often now, right now, that once you find some remnant in the sky, you look at the Chinese record and you find the record which corresponds to this explosion.
Okay, now we're just running out of time, but it's a fascinating topic. I just want to tell people, hopefully, are there still seats available for people who would like to go along, or
do
you know?
I couldn't say that from Paris.
You're not sure.
Maybe you can call the Dunsink Observatory and inquire about that.
Okay, the Dunsink Observatory, obviously people can check there, but it's on Wednesday of next week, yes?
Exactly,
the 7th
at
of September at 8 p.m. It's about 45 minutes, and there's questions and answers, etc. So, that for anybody interested in astronomy, that sounds like a really, really interesting one. And thanks very much for coming on and telling us about that. That's Dr. Jean-Marc Bonnet-Boudot. He's an astrophysicist in France at the French Atomic Energy Commission. And he's coming to Ireland next week. He's going to be talking about how the Chinese were way ahead of Europe in developing star charts or maps of the night sky. Okay, now just moving on. Well, in the news this week, and some science news this week, seeing as we're on the astronomical theme today, this issue of dark matter was in the news again. Dark matter is this explanation, if you like, for the matter that we can't see that scientists think exists out there in the universe. If we use the physics that we know, our understanding of physics, it doesn't actually explain how planets and gravity behaves in the universe. And they have postulated, scientists have postulated, that there may be a substance out there that they call dark matter. They don't know what it is, they haven't discovered it. And that this dark matter may explain why the planets stay together around the sun, around our sun, for example, and don't fly off into space, which they actually should do based on just our observations. But a new theory came out this week. A physicist based at CERN, that's the big European organization for research, where they had the Large Hadron Collider. That was in the news there recently, where they're trying to recreate the conditions of the Big Bang and to find out more about this whole dark matter issue. Well, scientist there, Dragan Hadjovic, I think is the pronunciation, he has proposed an idea that was published in the journal Astrophysics and Space Science, that actually there may be gravitational charges, a negative charge and a positive charge. And this would mean if there's matter and antimatter, that they can actually come together and they would actually interact in such a way that something would be obliterated and recreated. In any case, it's a new way of looking at things, and it may try eventually and help to explain this whole mystery of dark matter, which physicists are finding very compelling, but at the same time, very mysterious. Just one other thing that caught my attention. Science magazine reported on humans leaving Africa without their latest gadgets. Well, that apparently is a story about humans that left Africa about 1.8 million years ago. And you would think that the ones that left would have the latest gadgets, but no, they didn't. And the people that stayed at home apparently had more sophisticated weapons, axes, etc. They're trying to figure out why exactly that is the case. And it may be just as simple that the learning involved with creating the new gadgets just died out and was reinvented over and over again. Of course, people weren't communicating as closely with each other in those days as they are now. Right, we're going to move on. We're going to talk now to Dr. Andy Shearer at NUI Galway, NUI Galway Centre for Astronomy. We're talking about pulsars briefly there earlier, but they're certainly a big centre for research into pulsars, which are a particular type of star, and they have made a breakthrough that we're going to talk about now. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Sean.
Now, you say this is a culmination of 10 years' work, but before we get into that, maybe just, I've asked you before on air, but maybe for people who didn't tune in before, what exactly is a pulsar?
A pulsar is a type of neutral, so it's a neutron star. It's the end product of a star's life where it's the cinder which is left behind by a supernova explosion, which is one of the largest explosions we can get in nature.
Okay, you have a brilliant explanation here just in a note you gave me. I might just briefly mention this to listeners. So you say that pulsars are about 1.5 times the mass of the sun, but they're also so small that they could fit into Galway Bay.
Yeah.
So they're very, that's a great way of putting it, they're very extreme matter. So these are amazing things, really.
Well, they are. They represent matter at its most extreme before it goes rather odd, going, for example, falling into a black hole. Mm. So if it was any more massive, it would become a black hole. Or if it was any smaller, it would become a black hole.
Okay. And the density, incredibly dense, 1 million billion times greater than the density of Earth, of our Earth?
Yeah, roughly about that. And the way to look at it is that basically a neutron star is a very large atom. Mm. On its own. It has the same density as the atomic nucleus.
Okay. Is this how a star, like our sun, for example, is a star? Is this how stars eventually end up then?
They have to be massive stars.
Mm.
The sun will end up as a white dwarf, which is about the size of the Earth.
Okay.
So the sun, if our sun was about 8 times bigger, then its life would end in a massive supernova explosion, and the central core of it, of the star, would end up as a neutron star, and if it was rotating rapidly, we would see it as a pulsar.
Okay, so essentially when you see these things or observe them, this is a solar system which is disintegrating or coming to the end of its life.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a very pleasant place to be when the supernova explosion occurred.
Okay.
Having said that, the first planets were discovered around pulsars.
Right. Now, just to mention briefly, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, she discovered these things, of course, in the 60s. You know, we've talked again on air, but I mean, that was an accidental thing, but it was a big discovery at the time.
It was a massive discovery. She was a PhD student in Cambridge. She comes from Northern Ireland, so it's kind of Irish discovery. To give an idea of the kind of scale of the discovery, her PhD supervisor actually got the Nobel Prize for that work.
Right.
So, you know, it was on the top scale of kind of scientific discoveries.
Because, they were so odd. It was one of those cases where they checked the scientific instruments when they saw this. They couldn't explain it and wondering what's going on here. This doesn't fit any pattern.
Well, absolutely. And initially these things were, they referred to them as Little Green Men 1, Little Green Men 2. Because the signals looked like the kind of signals you'd expect from kind of extraterrestrial intelligence, but in the end they were discovered to be kind of very rapidly rotating stars.
And they were only half joking when they said that, weren't they? At the time, they didn't rule it out completely.
No, they didn't rule it out, but it's the kind of thing you don't shout about.
Yeah, I know.
Because you might be dismissed as being a slight lunatic if you're kind of claiming that seriously. So they were, when you make that kind of claim, you have to really double check very carefully. And when they did, they realised that there was a perfectly adequate natural explanation for the signals they saw.
Okay, now that was around 1967 or thereabouts?
Yeah, it was around in the late 60s.
Right, and your own centre, the NUI Galway Centre for Astronomy, you really do a lot of work on pulsars.
Yes, but we look at pulsars in a slightly different way. Jocelyn's work was looking at pulsars using large radio telescopes, mm-hmm. and most of the pulsars, and there are about 2,000 known, are detected using large radio telescopes either here or there's a lot of work which is done in Australia. Now, what we've done is that we've observed pulsars using our own optical instrumentation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the light from the pulsar varies very, very rapidly, so we need very special cameras which can take exposures which are effectively maybe a microsecond long.
Mm-hmm.
So we take a kind of million pictures a second.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
It is, you know, they're fast.
Yeah.
Now, when we do this, and particularly when we look at what's known as the polarization from the star of the light, we can actually begin to determine what the geometry, what the shape of the area where the light is coming from is. And that's the bit of work which we've just published.
Okay.
So what we did was we combined very, very detailed optical observations with very large computer simulations of the ways in which pulsars could work.
Okay.
And from that combination, a nice combination of computation and observation, we could then determine that the optical emission from the pulsar comes from a region which is about 200 or 300 kilometers above the neutron star surface.
Right.
And this was a bit of a surprise, because at that point, when most people were thinking for the optical emission, it was probably coming either from very, very close to the neutron star surface, effectively from the neutron star surface, or a long way away, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers away.
Right, so does this answer the question, the 40-year-old problem, how do pulsars work then?
It tells us how to answer the question.
Okay.
It tells us that we know now where the emission is coming from, where the light is coming from, and now what we have to do is do the next step, is to observe more of these pulsars and determine whether they all show the same characteristics. And if they do, we can then restrict it down. And if we are right, and we think we are, we can't see any reason what's wrong with our observations or our calculations, then really only one model can actually then explain the way in which the pulsars work, or way in which the high energy light from the pulsar comes in. And that's a model which is known as a slot gap model.
Right. And is that easy to explain in layperson's terms, or is it a tricky?
the basically the problem comes down to is, we have surrounding a pulsar what's known as a plasma.
Yeah, that's a hot gas, right?
It's a hot gas, very hot gas.
Yeah.
It's sometimes known as the last state of matter.
Mm-hmm.
And what will happen is that the plasma will concentrate itself around the very strong magnetic field around the pulsar. And if you think at night, if you go into the Arctic regions, you see the northern lights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of the combination, that's a kind of an interaction between the plasma, which is around the Earth, and the magnetic field, which is around the Earth.
Yes.
And that's known as the magnetosphere. And there's a similar magnetosphere around a pulsar. And what the slot gap model is saying is that the emission will come from the edge of the magnetosphere, from the surface all the way up to the edge of the magnetosphere.
Okay. Okay.
So it makes a serious restriction on what type of models are around, and then from that we hope that we can actually definitively say that we know how pulsars work.
So we're continuing on. I mean, we had an Irish woman who discovered these pulsars, and now your own work. I mean, you're very much continuing on the Irish tradition of trying to figure out exactly how they work now.
There is, and there's actually an even better Irish connection with this, because the pulsar which we observed was the Crab pulsar.
Yes.
Which is in the Crab Nebula, and the Crab Nebula was named the Crab Nebula by Lord Rosse, observing with the 2-meter telescope in Burr in the 1850s.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So the first
yeah.
time, you know, that was the first time that nebula was given a kind of descriptive name. Before that, it was known as M1.
Yeah.
And then the descriptive name came from an Irish astronomer, and it's been known as that ever since.
And the monks were recording some of these things as well, the Irish monks?
That's right. The Crab Nebula is the remnants of a supernova explosion which occurred in 1054. And mm-hmm. there were lots of kind of recordings of these in kind of Arabic texts and Chinese texts, but very few mentions of this in European texts. And virtually the only people who did mention it were Irish monks in the Irish annals in the 11th century.
Okay, so this work hopefully you'll continue to attract like good researchers and students to the research centre there, hopefully, and people that have an interest in these things.
We hope so, and we hope we can actually carry on getting the funding and the opportunities with large computers and large telescopes to continue this.
Okay, congratulations on your work, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon, Andy.
Thanks. I hope so.
Thanks a lot.
Great, thanks.
Okay, that's Dr. Andy Shearer. He's the lead researcher. We're talking about just a bit of interference there on the line. Yeah, we're talking about pulsars, a new pulsar discovery. Pulsars are a particular type of star, very extreme. They're very dense. They're about half times the mass of the sun. And this is how a star ends up its life, or some of them at least. And we didn't really know, astronomers didn't really know exactly how they worked. Now we know a little bit more. Okay, that's all we have time for this week, folks. Just to mention a few things. If you're interested in the show and about science in Ireland and around the world generally, then why not have a look at my blog, which is also called Science Spinning. That's at seanduke.com. Right, I've got podcasts of previous Science Spinning shows here on Dublin City FM, feature material from Science Spin, which is the magazine I'm involved with, and some video material, etc. So maybe have a look there. Also, if you'd like to get in touch with me here at the show about anything to do with the show or to suggest a story that may be worth covering, my email is sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. So until next week at the same time on Thursdays at 3:30, goodbye from me, Sean Duke, here on Science Spinning at 103.2 Dublin City FM.